Welcome back to another episode of the Stephen Reid Podcast. On today's episode, we have good friend Tom Gibbons, the paramedic, talking all about what goes on in the life of paramedic practice. I hope you enjoy. Tom, how you doing, mate?
Not so bad, mate. Not so bad.
How was that as a smooth introduction?
I like it. It still feels a bit alien, but I can get used to this.
I mean, hopefully the microphone sitting on the table isn't like that obvious, and we'll probably just forget about it soon. But
yeah,
let me introduce you a little bit more, and then you can introduce yourself in hopefully ways that I've missed out. So, Tom, you're a good friend of mine from uni. Mm-hmm. We lived in the same house together for second and third year, and you studied paramedic practice, right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a paramedic, how you go about going into paramedic practice and things like that.
I think for me, it was always one of those things where sort of medical things were an interest of mine, and I think it's quite a niche job. Like, you've got the likes of the Royal College of Nursing that has like hundreds of thousands of members, and the College of Paramedics has got like 60,000 members tops. So like the actual numbers, I'm not sure what the exact numbers of paramedics employed in the UK is, but in terms of a job role, for me, it seems like everything because I do it every day, you know, but actually it's quite a small part of a very large machine. Mm. And often an overlooked part sometimes. Not so much recently. I think there's been a big push towards like sort of publicising paramedic and paramedics and pre-hospital care, probably the best way to put it.
So are we growing in numbers in paramedics then in the UK in general?
Yes, I think so. I think purely just because the need is becoming greater, and the more publicity something gets, the more money it gets, you know, which isn't necessarily a good thing. It shouldn't have to be like that, but tends to be like that. So I think the more money services get, you know, and foundation trusts get, the more they're then able to employ paramedics. So I think slowly, yes, there is becoming more, but I wouldn't say there's a vast increase. Mm. I think it's just becoming a bit more of a well-known about profession, you know.
I think there's still a huge lack in knowledge in terms of what paramedics do and what the job role involves. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea of a paramedic is like go out on a daily basis and save lives, right? But from talking to you very briefly about it, it's very obvious that that's not the bulk of the job, is that right?
I mean, yeah, you say from talking to me, you could probably say from hearing me bitch and moan about the job, but it's not necessarily like that. But yeah, I think you are right. There's a perception that we go out and, like, even like in a lot of these sort of 999 watch emergencies, there's this perception that we sort of go out and every day there's something going on, and it's not like that. Majority of the time, like, it's a very, very basic sort of caregiving role that is a lot of the time you are a giant yellow taxi. And sort
with
of
flashing
like,
lights
yeah,
on.
Yeah, like just a quicker taxi. And sometimes it's a negative, but not necessarily always a negative. You know, like a lot of the time you go to people that realistically in the past would have managed, you know, but because the service is available now, you know, that's what you go to. And I think certainly in the profession, there are some people that get very upset about that. I think people, sort of people that work in pre-hospital care sometimes feel like they're taken advantage of by the general public.
Because their skills aren't utilised in
the way they want. Pre-hospital care is a really strange one, because you are trained for pretty much every eventuality, from the most extreme to very, very minor ailments and illnesses.
Okay. So give us a couple of examples then. So what is a minor example of what is a minor thing that you'd go to, and what could be the extreme on the opposite end of that?
So a lot of the sorts of things that we go to very, very regularly that you often don't see on these programs are things like your sort of abdo pain query causes. I work in the Northeast, which was very heavy on coal mining, steel plants, very sort of hard working, but at the time, not very safety conscious jobs. So you have a lot of people with sort of long term lung problems and things like that, COPD, sort of emphysema, things like that sort of need care regularly in the community, or are more prone to suffering from bouts of serious or could be potentially serious illness. So we'd spend a lot of our day, like say that you don't see on these programs, going to these sorts of people. Mm-hmm. You know, your abdo pains, shortness of breath, and your chest pains. Things that realistically, there's not a lot I could do. And realistically, for those that are well, which isn't all of them, they're not all well, don't get us wrong. Some of them you turn up to and you go, thank heavens you called, because mate, you are on death's door here. Right. But a lot of them you get to, you think, it could have been bad, but it's not, and there would be nothing stopping this person from finding an ulterior transport to hospital or self-caring and staying at home. And that's not to their own detriment, you know, that's by no means something that I would say is their own fault. But certainly I think that's kind of the reality of the job. Okay. There's a lot of like,
so that's that like sort the, of stuff. The day-to-day, almost the mundane.
Yeah, the mundane stuff that's pops. Like you turn up, there's not a lot you can do, you reassure people, you take them in hospital because they do need to be there, but they probably could have got there by taxi. But okay. Now you're there, it's easier to take them and monitor them.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. So take us to the other end then.
What, and sort of,
maybe not that you've experienced yet, but what are the types of extreme events or calls that you could be going to?
The mad thing is, you name it, basically. You name it, if something was to go wrong in the pre-hospital environment, from the massive, you know, to like the big scary stuff, your terrorism, your sort of major incident stuff, to quite acute but still very serious incidents, you know, your big car crashes, things like that. And I think that's what I love about my job so much, is that I can turn up for work and my first couple of jobs could be a couple of people with shortness of breath or a couple of little old dears that have fallen over. You get them sorted, you reassure them, you either take them to hospital, leave them at home, and that's that. Next thing you know, you've had your bait, you come off your bait, and you have your lunch.
Okay.
You have your pecked lunch, and then you have your bait, you come off your bait, and next thing you know, you're heading to like a 3-car RTC, and you know, you're going to be the first one there, and you're going to have to assess people and decide who you need and who you don't need, you know?
Sure.
And it's good fun. And I don't know if fun's often the right way to talk about it, but fun's how I like to look at it.
Okay.
Because, yeah, I do enjoy that. And I do enjoy both sides of it. But, yeah.
So there's obviously can be some really challenging things that you have to deal with, and mm-hmm. that, you know, that's pretty common knowledge for a paramedic, right? But mm-hmm. what kinds of traits does it take for someone to become a paramedic? Because it's certainly not a job I could do, and it's not for everyone, right?
No, and I think I don't like to big up too much, because I think everybody's job that everybody does have a certain element of challenge to it. You know, no matter what the job is, from what people would call the most mundane stuff to very, very serious, complicated jobs, like mine can be sometimes. Like people, everybody's job has their own challenge. Plus, I don't like blowing smoke up people's asses and sort of affirming what people think about their own job sometimes. But yeah, anybody can do it. It's about how you approach it, you know?
Okay.
I would argue that I think because you're in an environment where everybody's been through it, you know, that everybody has had that job that they always go back to that will stick with them forever. You know, I mean, I've been in the job full-time sort of at post-university for a year and a half, and I already have stories that you sort of your go-to is things that stick with you, and they're always going to stick with us, and I'm never going to forget them, no matter how hard I try. But I think it's because everybody's got that, it becomes normal, but it also becomes easier to deal with because your colleagues have all been there, you know, and they've all been to their first ever cardiac arrest or their first ever hanging or their first ever major like suicide or things like the really quite emotional, quite traumatic things. Everybody's done one. So everybody, you know, you can take that patient to hospital or whatever, however it ends up, and then there will be somebody in hospital that more than likely has been through it, you know, and can tell you about what it feels like. And I think generally we're not as good at it, but we're getting better at sharing those sorts of things as well. You know, there's a big focus on sort of learning to be able to go to your colleagues. I've just had this and it was fucking awful and like I don't know what to do for myself, you know? And you're able to do that, you know, and there are always managers on call. You know, and to be very frank, you know, there has been things that there was a job in particular that I went to where sort of a gentleman was on a bridge over a major road and he was on the wrong side of the barriers and decided that he was going to try and jump. Now, luckily, his friends were there, the police were there, they managed to keep a hold of him, and this gentleman didn't jump, and it was a positive outcome, you know, that this gentleman was fine, you know. But believe it or not, you know, and I have seen things that have been more visceral and much more emotive, but that was what kept me up at night. You know, that was something that I woke up, and I think because I felt like most of the time in my job, I am in complete control. It might all be going horribly wrong, but I am in control of how horribly wrong it's going. And as long as it doesn't go completely, you know, tits up before we get to hospital, it's generally fine. But I think in a job like that, I had no control over whether that guy was going to jump or not going to jump. And that sticks with you, you know, and that. But there's always, so I woke up at 2 a.m. and that was it, you know, I was in an absolute state. But there was a manager who was on duty at work who I could call and be like, this is what's happened. And you can talk that through with somebody, yeah. And that's always there. And we're getting better at that. And I think that's, for me, dealing with these sorts of events on the regular, things that some people only go through a couple of times in their lives, you know, deaths of relatives or, you know, seeing something horrible like a car crash or something really horrible. Seeing them regularly, the key, certainly for myself, is to be able to offload that to somebody who has also been through it. And I think that's almost the beauty, whereas, like, you know, if you come across, say if you came across something in the street that you saw that was quite traumatic, may not be many people in your life that could also turn around and go, yeah, I had one the other day as well, it was awful, you know? Yeah. And that's,
how can you relate to that? Yeah. With, you know, who do you go to when something like that happens?
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And whereas, you know, for me, it's,
how does someone support you with that then?
Most of the time, it's probably a shockingly high amount of time, it's humour. And we often laugh because these programmes, you know, 9-9, what's your emergency, all these sorts of things, they're very, very PC. But actually, out on the road, when a camera's not on a crew and, you know, or you're talking in the hospital corridor out of earshot of anybody else, the things that get said and the things that get joked about are often quite dark, and the humour that we have is often quite black. But I think you do that because you can, you know, and because that's how you deal with it. And by making light of these things, it does exactly what it says. It makes them lighter. It makes them easier to deal with, you know. And I do think that's got an important role. I'm a big fan of dark humour. I'm a big fan of being able to take anything that's happened, nothing's off limits, and being able to just have a laugh about it, you know. When appropriate.
I'm sure it's one of those things where that the phrase, you know, either laugh or cry about it, mm-hmm. you know, is mm-hmm. really relevant.
Very, very true. But also, I think I'm a big believer in both are appropriate and both are healthy. You know, if you see something that is traumatic and horrendous, you sometimes need to cry about it. Like, that is appropriate, you know. And it's similar to a conversation we've had before. You know, emotions are just mixes of chemicals in your brain. And if something's making a certain mixture, you can't help that. And there's no point in fighting it. If something's making you upset, then you're allowed to be upset, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just sort of how you deal with that. And I think spending too long being like, oh, well, I can't cry at work, that's not appropriate. That's unhealthy, you know? But the type of job that we do, and it's a bizarre thing to behold, because the sorts of people that work in the ambulance service in the Northeast, stereotypically, I mean, it's a job that initially the ambulance service, as it is today, was run by the councils locally, and it was done by bin men. They would go and collect the bins in the morning, come back, change their uniform and jump in an ambulance and literally just pick people up and take them. And that wasn't that long ago, you know, that was within sort of living memory for some people.
So
the kinds of people that you have stereotypically in the ambulance service are sort of more working class, down to earth men's men, you know, and it's changing slowly, but stereotypically even the women are men's men, you know, like that's sort of the attitude that prevails. And yet I have seen some people that are very, very masculine and very, very cry, you know, and shed a tear at things, because that's what you deal with, and everybody is okay with that. You know, there is no judgment, there is no like, oh, you know, he's a this or he's a that. It just happens. And I think I would like to think I have quite a healthy relationship with my emotions. You know, I'm quite in tune with what I'm feeling and why I'm feeling it, because I think you have to be, you know.
So do you think that's the type of person you were naturally, or do you think that your job's made you that way?
A bit of both. I mean, you probably understand even just from when we were at university together, like, I've always been a bit of an emotional person, and I always sort of, I would like to say that I have been very in tune with my emotions, but I think certainly, it's very easy for the sort of people that, like, and I do not want to slate you here for a second, mate, but the types of people that meditate and sit in nice sort of calm rooms with the music on and, you know, their arms and legs folded, and they're not quite going home, but you can imagine them doing it, and they're sort of the sort of stuff that you do on the regular, right, with your incense and your all that sort of stuff. It's easy to do that if you live a life where you go to work, you work a fairly standard 9-to-5 and come home, do your meditation, and it's easy to then sit and go, I'm at peace with my emotions. I think it's much less easy when you go to work and, like, the sort of stuff you're seeing is horrendous, and then come home and go, I'm still at peace with my emotions. Like, and I think to do that, to be like that, instead of feeling and to just be, oh, I'm at peace with my emotions, I don't feel this, is more unhealthy, you know. And I think my job, I've always been very sort of emotionally intelligent, emotionally in touch with my own emotions, but also my job has forced me to feel a greater range of emotion, we should say, and more regularly, you know. I deal with grief, not necessarily personal grief, but grief as an emotion, fairly regularly, you know. I deal with the opposite end of the spectrum, very, very happy, very, very relieved people very, very often, you know, as well. So I think because you come across that more, it's like anything, the more experience you have of it, the better at dealing with it you become, you know.
Are there any other ways then that you've changed since, say, going back to before university then, before you started doing paramedic practice? And I know that you were involved somewhat with St. John's
beforehand, volunteered and stuff for a little while. I think now that I do it, I think initially I was very sort of, I was very proud of what I did, but I would imagine almost to there was a degree of hubris, you know. I was almost so proud that I became quite, well, my job's really important, what do? You know, and I think now that I do it full time, it's lost that, you know. It's still a job that I enjoy, but it's something that I understand that it's a sort of 12 to 12 job that pays the bills like anything else. And so that's certainly one way that I've sort of, I would say I've grown, you know. But also, I suppose I felt more emotions since starting the job, which sounds bizarre, but like, you know, when people lose family members, they react in the most bizarre ways, and you just kind of deal with it. And I've experienced a range of ways an emotion can affect somebody, you know, like, we all see grief as this thing where you put on black and you give people lilies and you go to funerals and it's all very somber. I've been with some... I've been in some families where grief is not a peaceful emotion at all. And grief is quite a scary emotion to be around, especially others that are dealing with grief. That you sort of think, ooh, this is a bit ropey. These people are not dealing with this well. But that is a manifestation of grief, you know. Mm. And it's still something that can happen. And I've also seen some people deal with grief fairly well, you know. It's sort of in one particular story, when you work on somebody in a cardiac arrest when they die, it's often not, it's not nice, but also it's not very clean, you know.
When you're doing like chest compressions,
yes, when you're doing CPR and things like that, you often not only do you damage the person that you're dealing with, but also, like, often when people die, they can evacuate their bowels without realizing and things like that. So it can be quite a messy affair. Now, often I'll make a point of, if we are unsuccessful and unfortunately somebody dies, trying to make that scene as peaceful as possible. You know, I'll remove all of the medical equipment and sort of strip it back to that person in their own environment. Yes, they may be lying on the floor, but we'll cover them with a blanket, we'll put the head on a pillow, things like that, and make it seem more normal. But I've seen some people, after having lost their wife of 50 years or whatever it was, be more focused on trying to clean the mess we've made on the carpet than dealing with what's going on in front of them. Because, again, that is another way somebody deals with grief, and the same for many different
emotions.
Almost just
avoiding it and pretending that it's not there.
Yeah, denial. Yeah, very much so. And again, that is something else that you're having to deal with. You know, not only is he having to deal with it, but you're then having to sort of help that person deal with it, because you can't leave that person in the house having not come to terms with it. You have to try and help that process along.
And how do you begin to even think about doing that as a 23-year-old bloke, right? I wouldn't know where to start. If I walked into a room where someone was dealing with such an acute event and their emotions were such a roller coaster, I don't think I have the skills or the appreciation to know where to begin to help someone.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, right up until that day, I don't think I did either. You know, okay. It's not something that is very easy to prepare for, but I think having quite a high degree of emotional intelligence but also people skills, you know, the gift of the gab, if you want to call it that, like, having that allows you to just start somewhere, you know, just start by having a conversation and, you know, and doing it that way. Mm. And that you also find that there is no right or wrong way of doing things, you know, like, sometimes you engage in conversation or you try and help families through things and it is the total wrong thing to do. And you also have to accept that side of things as well, is that you're not this hyper-emotional, hyper-in-touch-with-your-feelings kind of, yeah, I can help people deal with everything. Like, sometimes your presence at a scene is the last thing anybody wants. Sure. And sometimes you also have to know when to just cut your losses and allow people to deal with whatever emotion it is themselves, you know?
Mm. Well, so we had training at work, right, by a chaplain who volunteers and comes around on the wards and talks to families and particularly deals with loss and bereavement. And actually, this training came about because a colleague of mine said to them, I don't know what to say to someone who is grieving over the loss of their wife or husband, especially in our environment where they've been maybe together for 50, 60 years
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
How do you talk about that? And basically, the training all boiled down to the fact that there is no wrong thing to do or say. Just saying something
yeah.
and allowing the person to deal with it their way
yeah.
is the best thing
and
that you
can do. And I 100% agree with that. And I think, yeah, it's that. It's not... I think people get very caught up on what to say. And it's not about what to say. It's about appreciating what the emotion is in that room. You know, sometimes you don't have to say anything, you know. Consoling somebody can be very simple as, you know, just offering quite literally a physical shoulder to cry on, you know, and or sort of physically helping them through that emotion as opposed to coming in. Because I think words are a very set thing and words alone have no emotion, you know. And so trying to deal with these sorts of things or somebody... be it a friend or a relative going through a tough time purely with words is often not the right way of looking at it, you know. So to look at this problem in a very one-dimensional way, oh, this person's feeling grief, I must say something to stop them feeling grief, it is often fairly ineffectual, you know. And sometimes you just have to appreciate this person's feeling grief, let's see how they feel grief first before I start reacting to that, you know. Some people, it's a very sort of, right, you did your best, thank you very much, you know, and you say, look, you're very welcome, you know, take care, all the rest of it, you take your equipment out, come back in with the paperwork and make sure that the family is all right. And often that's that, and it's almost a business transaction. Sure. You come in, you do your job, you leave. Some people, it's the complete opposite, you know. They're leaning on you, they're telling you stories, they're crying, you know, and you're there with tissues and you really offer somebody something to open up to, you know. So it's about appreciating what somebody wants first as opposed to trying to create one solution that fits all, because it doesn't, you know.
So as a job then, being a paramedic offers a whole range of extremes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And a whole lot of low points, I imagine.
Yeah.
And some really tough emotions. But take us through some of the high points in your career so far. What have been the highlights that you go away from leaving work knowing that, you know, you've had an amazing day?
Mm-hmm. You know what it is? Some of my job is very rewarding, but often it's very, very sort of funny, you know, like for lack of a better way to be able to describe it. It is, a lot of what I deal with is inherently strange and therefore funny, and people appreciate that themselves, you know. Like a 40-year-old working class bloke who's put his back out straining for a poo and can't move off the toilet will inherently find that funny as long as you go in and you're not awful about it. So you know, so often my job is full of situations that are either very, very bizarre or very, very funny. And I think people don't appreciate that as much, you know, is that you can walk away from some of the things we deal with and you just have to stop with your colleague and you just have to be like, what the fuck have we just gone through? Like, what have we just seen? Or what has that person just done? Or, you know, and just appreciating the little things, you know, and I think, yeah, and that's sort of one of the other extremes. Don't get me wrong, I could talk to you all day long about the airy-fairy, oh, it's dead rewarding and stuff, which it is, you know, don't get me wrong. I've been there for, you know, one shift hit me in particular where we sort of, in the middle of the shift, we were there with a single mother as she birthed her first child, and that was very, very rewarding, and, you know, and I mean, even now, I remember the name of the first child I ever, I want to say gave birth to, but not personally, but you know, like I birthed, yeah, that's it. I pulled on, I don't know, like I caught. I still remember now, you know, and somewhere out there, there is a child called Hazel that is wherever she is and doing whatever she is and will probably be about two or three or whatever it is now. And but I will never forget that, you know. I will never, ever forget that. And that, it's very, very positive. But also, like, in that same shift, you know, we had a birth like that, and then you were there with a gentleman who passed away in a care home, you know, and you were there with the family, and you, I literally monitored this gentleman until his heart was no longer beating, you know, and that was the end, and that was closure for them. And so, yeah, the job is up and down all over the place, and sometimes just appreciating that when you go home and somebody says, how was work, you go, yeah, it was all right, you know, standard day at work, and not putting too much credence on, oh my goodness, like I brought a life into the world and then watched one disappear. That's so like spiritual. And sometimes just appreciate, yeah, I went in, I did my job this time, and I did my job this time. Jobs are good, and then going home and just appreciating that that's that.
Sure. But with that in mind, then, what does a normal day look like to you?
It depends on what people want to believe, you know. Like I could sit here, right, and I could tell people that listen to this, I could sit here and go, you know what, my normal day is full of so many extremes. Like we'll go and we'll be there with a family who have a sick or dying relative and blah blah blah. But really, a normal day for me is turning up to work, going out, picking up patients, many of whom aren't seriously unwell, or many jobs that don't involve a lot of emotion, that just involve going into somebody's house. Patient's well, but he still needs to be in hospital. Jump on the ambulance and let we go into hospital. Mm. And that's a full day, you know, just a full day of that. And it's okay. Just a normal
and
it, so job.
And
like
that's 12
else.
Hours as well.
And that's, 12 hours of that, a couple of breaks in there, you know. And that's a standard day. That if you ever ask somebody what a normal day in the ambulance service is like, that's what it is. I think there are some days where they're full of straight, like, full moons are strange. Friday, Saturday nights. So, because I work, you know, in the city centre as well. So Friday, Saturday nights are bizarre. They're often full of weird and wonderful. In a good way, you know, in a very... personally, yes, dealing with intoxicated adults all day, you feel like you should be working in a playgroup or a creche or something. But, like, it is still part of my job, you know, and that is still something I do. But... And often drunks are some of the most enjoyable patients, especially when they're funny about it. You know, we had a gentleman who broke his arm dressed as somebody from WrestleMania. And because the WrestleMania cast were still quite intoxicated, I refereed a WrestleMania game until they were definitely finished, that the WrestleMania session or whatever it's called was over, you know, and... So often the job is full of, like I said before, very, very sort of humorous, very sort of interesting and bizarre things, you know. And I love that. I love that about my job. I think if you're willing to engage with the general public in the most weird and bizarre way, then they're willing to do the same back, you know. You can't make it up sometimes. You really can't, you know.
And another part of your job that I am fascinated by is not just the going out and you know, doing your paramedic stuff, but it's the being on the van or the driving around, like being able to drive through red lights, going at like
You know what
60
it is, right?
And
don't
a 30
get me wrong,
zone
as much as I don't know how much of this I should actually say, but that's my favourite part of the job. Like, as much as I enjoy dealing with patients, and oh yes, it's very rewarding, or fucking driving around in an ambulance, fucking blue lights on, causing absolute mayhem at 4:30 in the afternoon, it's great fun. It's absolutely fucking, it's wonderful. And to be able to put a pair of blue lights on a 5.5-ton van and suddenly it's all right to drive at like 80, 90 miles an hour in a built-up area, like, it's crazy. It's absolute madness. And yes, you do get extra training to do that, but I'm still 23 years old driving a massive van really fast. Like, it's a lot of fun, you know? And again, my job is the best when you appreciate things like that, you know? Instead of looking at it as this super-duper, oh, yeah, it's dead emotional. Nah, you go in a van, you drive around really fast, you pick people up, have a bit of crap with them and take them in the hospital, you know? Like, and that's the job in a nutshell. And I do love that bit of it. I really do love that bit of it. Don't get me wrong, it can go very wrong very quickly, which is also, you know, sort of understandable. But And as long as you appreciate that it's a dangerous thing that you're doing, you can still have fun while you do the dangerous thing. Like, why the fuck not? Why the fuck not?
Okay. But yeah. So we've talked an awful lot about being a paramedic, and that is a huge part of you. But take us through a couple of other things that you enjoy doing. What, you know, what do you do outside of work time when you've done 4 days on and you've got a couple of days off? What do you like to do, and how do you spend your time to wind down from that?
I would say sleeping and crying are a very big part of my free time.
Sleeping and crying together, or
yeah, I mean sometimes both. Yes, sometimes crying till I sleep till I cry. Like I think a lot of your spare time is. Some people spend a lot of their spare time doing stuff still very related to work. You know, I know of a few people who are being a paramedic or being part of the sort of pre-hospital emergency care is very much everything that they do. For me, it's a job. I do a little bit of volunteering. I volunteer with the St. John Ambulance. So I do a bit of that in my spare time because I enjoy it, because I enjoy my job, and so I like doing more of it in my spare time. But I don't do loads. You know, I appreciate that I go to work and do 12 till 12 or 9 till 9 of that stuff. I don't want to then go and do another lot, you know, every weekend. But every once in a while, plus you get to see some cool things and you get some interesting places. So that's a lot of what I do. I also do a lot of stuff where you sort of, you totally take your mind off sort of work. I have a computer, I play a lot of video games, I do a lot of, Wallace calls it escapism, you know, and I like to just sometimes go and be me, put the computer on, and pretend to be a space captain for like 3 hours, or wake up and go and like romp around the world full of dinosaurs for a day, like, because, I don't know, like, again, it's that thing is where you deal with a lot of very interesting emotions or very stressful emotions. Sometimes you just want to come home and totally forget about it and go and fly around in space for an hour. Like, you know, and you have to appreciate that as that is, you know, that's just part and parcel of, again, how you deal with it.
What would be your go-to game then? If you have you've had a really shit day and all you want to do is come home and have that escapism, what do you go to first?
You know what it is? If I had a go-to game, I would spend so much less on video games, and I wish I did have a go-to game so that my wallet didn't suffer as much for my pastimes, I suppose. But yeah, I don't really have one. I like the fact that there are lots of different kinds of video games and things like that that you can go and play, and you could be, like, depending on whatever the feeling is, be it like a, you know, if I want to go and be a pirate or be a whatever, you know, and it's a very sort of, you could almost call it childish in terms of, you know, doing that sort of thing, but it's very enjoyable to just be something totally different, you know.
I kind of like that about you though, because you have a very serious and a very adult job, but and on the flip side of that, you're also able to just be a young lad still and have that time away from it.
This is it. And I think you have to appreciate that. Yes, with my job comes a lot of responsibility. You know, you have to be very... I'm part of a profession. I'm a registered professional. I have to be professional in everything that I do. But with that said, there's nothing stopping me from still being a 23-year-old lad and going out for a drink on the weekend. You know, I've been off for a week and... You know, I've spent less days sober than I have drunk this week, but that's part of being 23 and being off and enjoying it, you know? So I would say, and that's important to do as well. I think some people get very sort of switched on with paramedic or pre-hospital care is everything that they do and that's everything they are, and they come home from work and I'm going to look for more courses to do or more. And if that's what people do and that's how they get by, I appreciate that, you know, and I appreciate that that's how just some people spend their time. But for me, the easiest way to deal with the emotion at work is to be able to come away from work and switch off from work, you know, and totally do something totally different, you know. While I was at university, I played a lot of roller derby, you know, and things like that, you know. I've just recently started again.
For those people who don't know what roller derby is, can you give us a little bit of
it? I still think I know fully what roller derby is, mate. But It's a cross between I would probably say rugby and tag on skates is probably the in a circle. Like, there's a lot to it. There's a lot to it. And I would probably need another hour's podcast to explain the ins and the outs of it. But essentially it's a team sport with full contact where you're trying to get past four people on the other team who are trying to stop you getting past them. And it's full contact and it's very sort of full on. And I think that sort of side of things is important to be able to go after work and do something also very physical, you know. It's quite a sedentary job. I sit and I drive an ambulance, go and stand in somebody's house, stand around for a bit, have a chat, and then go and sit back in the ambulance with the patient, you know. So I think it is important to do that, but to do something that allows that physical release of energy or whatever it is. So,
sure. Yes,
so I'm looking forward to getting back into it.
Okay, and so the basics then... You're in a circle.
Oh, we're really going into this. Well, all right, okay.
Yeah, because I'm still... As someone that doesn't play Royal Derby, I've never been to see it. It's not televised because it's a bit of a niche sport.
Yeah, it is a very niche sport, mate. Like,
tell me, go into a bit more detail. What is the aim? How does one go about being successful and winning a roller derby game?
I mean, I don't know because I've not been there. Like, I'm not a successful roller derby player. I just play it for fun. But I would say that in terms of the aim of the game is there's five people on each team and you've got two teams, right? One person on each team scores the points, all right? That person wears it's called a panty, but it's actually just a blanket over the top of the helmet with a star on it to let you know that that's the person that you're trying to stop. And they then have to pass all of the members of the other team, because it's in like you're travelling around in an oval, in a donut-shaped oval. They have to pass all members of the other team to score points, and you score a point per member of the other team that you get past. So the aim is to, as a team, collectively stop that person from getting past. So you form things called walls. You've always got to be moving. You've always got to be moving clockwise. And you form things called walls to stop the other person with a panty on their head getting past you. And that's the premise. Now, not only are you trying to stop the other person from the other team, but you're trying to help your person on your team get past their team. Because there's almost...
So that's going on consecutively.
So it's both going on at the same time, yes. So you've got five players from each team on the donut at all times, you know. So not only are you trying to help your guy get past them, but they're trying to help their guy get past you, and you're also trying to stop their guy getting past you.
So it's like defence and attack at the same time.
Yes.
And instead of a rugby ball, you've got a person.
It's a person, yes. And you don't throw them around as much as you do in rugby. But apart from that, it is full contact. So, you know, nothing is off limits apart from the spine, I think. As long as there are set areas that you can contact, but as long as two contact areas hit, you can throw people around. You can, you know, it's really
quite physical. So you're using your body then?
Yes, yeah, to physically stop people, you know?
Okay.
It can get quite interesting, can get quite physical, it can get quite painful at times, but lots of fun, you know, so we'll see.
Okay, so that's coming up.
That
then. That
starts
what
again as of Wednesday. I did play at university, but unfortunately I had all of my gear stolen while I was at uni, like you remember, so unfortunately I've not played for a little while, you know.
Okay.
Yes, starting to get a bit of a tum, so I thought I'll have to do something. So we'll start that again. That should be good.
And for those of you who are unable to detect Tom's voice or accent, you are a Geordie.
Yes,
you're from Newcastle.
Yeah,
Tell us a bit about what it's like growing up in Newcastle and being a Geordie.
I love it. I feel so blessed to have an accent from somewhere that, like, people always go, "Oh, you're a Geordie. Oh, like, Geordies are so friendly." Like, you know what I mean? Like, it sounds really awful, but I'm glad that I have a Geordie accent as opposed to many other accents that are out there, you know? And it was purely luck of the draw. Like, I didn't choose, but, like, I would still say I'm quite glad to have an accent like I do. And you can tell a Geordie accent from a mile off, you know? Like, so when we were out last night, one of your friends is from Blythe, isn't she? So... So yeah, you could tell straight off the bat that she was, she had a twang of Geordie in there. So yeah, so and it's nice, and people recognise that. And I would say I'm not the most Geordie, as that was pointed out to me to me the other night. But I would still say I have a, I'd certainly say I have a twang. I'd like to think I have a twang anyway. But yeah.
And growing up then, did you always know that you wanted to go into being a paramedic, or what were you like as a kid?
I don't know. Like, I think it sort of, people put a lot of credence on like, oh, have you always wanted to do this? Have you always wanted to help people and stuff? And yeah, but in the same sense, like, sort of in a very down-to-earth way, I wasn't clever enough to do medicine. So I always enjoyed medical things and never really realised what else there was to do, you know? So I very much, it was, I was torn, you know? And I think if you don't get into medicine, people immediately go, why don't you be a nurse? And for me, I just couldn't even imagine working next to a career that I, that, you know what I mean? You almost feel like you're settling. Sure. And not that I'm saying that about all nurses, but on a personal level, sort of, for me to then be a nurse would feel like I'm sort of compromising. So for a while, I tried all sorts. I did a lot of work experience teaching. I quite wanted to be a teacher for a long time. And would still love to get into teaching in some form eventually, because I still very much enjoy it. I like the sound of my own voice. so as you could probably tell.
That's very honest of you.
Yeah, like, I'll say that. Like, no, I think as much as I take the mic, like, sort of, I like having conversations like this with people, you know. I like to just sit and chat with people. And I think sometimes people that want to learn from you, you can have the most interesting conversations with. I love being questioned. I love somebody stopping and going, well, why did you do that? Or why are you doing it this way? Or, you know, and I love that. And I really sort of, I really admire what teachers do, because I think it's a really important profession. Looked into being a prison guard. But yeah, no, not even close, mate. Yeah, and then didn't really know what I wanted to do. I'd been in scouts for a little bit, and I was a first aider with the scouts. And they said, look, you know, I like, if you like doing that sort of thing, because when you take a bunch of, like, these would have been explorers, they were like 14 to 18, and I think I was like 19, I was a leader at the time. And like, kids, especially young lads at that age, are fucking stupid. Like, the shit that would happen, you know, like, and you just... So we were forever patching up holes that, like, shouldn't be there, you know? Like, people have thrown themselves down things, and, like, you just think, why? You're an idiot. But, like, you would just have to patch them up anyway. And somebody who was there, she was a nurse, and she was an A&E nurse, and so she dealt with paramedics all the time. And she said, look, if you enjoy this side of things, why don't you go and look into being a paramedic? And never even... I had no idea what the career involved or what, you know, and that's where I started the St. John stuff, and I enjoyed that as well. So I sort of thought, right, well, this might be for me. And I think I will happily hold my hands up and admit it was also a very luck of the draw, right place, right time thing, if that's a, like, you know, I was just at the right age to apply for university.
Because it's only recently become a degree, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, very recently.
Like you said, it was, it used to be... Thus,
yeah, yeah. It used to be run by the council, and you just used to go, and you had, like, essentially a converted bread van, and you just used to go and pick people up. You had a little first aid course and a little first aid box, but you didn't use it. You just picked them up and took them to hospital, you know? So it's only recently become a degree-focused job. So I was just at the right time where, as they were bringing in the degree, I was of the age where I could apply for a degree, and got in. So, you know, I would certainly never big myself up. I got like 90 UMS points or whatever you call it below what was required. I still think it might have been a clerical error that I got into Teesside anyway, but I got there, you know, so that's that. And sort of, yeah.
I'm sure your experience and passion would have come through in the fact that you've got years worth of St. John's experience and you'd been a first aider, and you clearly showed that you were
passionate. Do you want to know what it was as well?
Interesting.
I get a lot of this ability to talk for hours from my mum, and she's going to listen to this afterwards, and because she loves this sort of stuff, and also she loves you, Stephen. She's a big Stephen fan. And I get a lot of this. I get a lot of the gift for the gab from my mum. You know, she was somebody. She's the sort of person that she's a wonderful, wonderful woman. I think especially like sort of I don't know when this is going out, but today being Mother's Day, you know, like I think it's important to appreciate that. Yeah, she's the sort of lady. She was forever while I was younger organising everything. You know, she was one of these mums where it was like if something was going on at the school, she was probably involved, or you know, with the scouts, she'd be involved in organising something and this, that, and the other. So I get a lot of that from her, and she knows everybody. Like round where we live, she knows everybody. She and the other ladies that live on the street once busted a brothel that had taken up residence at the bottom of my road. I don't know how much of this I can and can't tell, but why not, right? So there was a house for rent at the bottom of my street, and it makes me sound like I'm from a really shitty area. Like, it's not. It's quite a nice area, which is why it was a perfect place for an unsuspecting brothel. And the ladies of the wives and the mothers of the street all got together, and it was a very like, oh, this is, because they regularly would have a bitch and a moan while talking in the street, and they were like, oh, this is really peculiar. There's suddenly lots of cars and men appearing at the bottom of the street. And eventually, through sort of just sheer sort of citizen detective work, the mothers of the street found out that this must be some sort of brothel. There must be some shady goings on going. So they set up what really could only be called 24-hour surveillance of this property, right? Through this little old lady who, bless her cotton socks, has passed away but lived across the street from this place, who took great pleasure in, like, taking the name, the car types and the registration numbers and how long they were there for and when they came and the fact that such and such would be here in his black car every Wednesday, he'd only stay for 10 minutes and blah, blah, blah. And then with all of that presented, they then presented that to police, and then obviously there was a raid and it was busted and stuff. And so my mum is one of these people that really, like, sort of has her finger on the pulse of what is going on in my local area. She knows people. She's a very good lady to know, even better lady to have as your own mother. So she knew a paramedic. She knew somebody who was a paramedic. It was like a husband of somebody at work. And she put me in touch with him. And I think what a lot of it was being able to speak to a paramedic who was quite switched on. He was able to tell me all about sort of the new developments in paramedicine and the fact they were going degree-based and this, that, and the other. And because of that, because I could then convey that at an interview, and I have the gift of the gab from my mum, like, it was very much a case of, like, I was able to sort of blag it in, I suppose, like, you know, purely just through knowing the right things to say and knowing what would go well in an interview, purely because I'd spoken to a paramedic the night before who said, say these things and you'll get in. And I did, you know. So I think a lot of it was just through that, you know, just through sheer having the gift of the gab and being able to talk shit for long enough, you know.
So you're currently a year and a half into being a paramedic.
Uh-huh.
And so what is out there in terms of the next steps?
Oh, man, you're really sort of... This is my current dilemma, is that I would like to say that I'm a sort of... a year and a half in, and I'm ready for that next step. Now, at the moment, I'm what's called a newly qualified paramedic. So it's a bit like being a newly qualified teacher. You are a teacher in every sense of the word, or you are a paramedic in every sense of the word, but there are some restrictions as to what you can do, but also you have to be... you're responsible to a senior clinician or somebody who has been a paramedic for longer. So at the moment... And that ends after 2 years. So once that's come to an end, I think that's then going to be the point where I look at sort of what else is out there, or sort of where the other options are. I'm very lucky in that there's a lot going on in the pre-hospital environment, and a lot of it is being led by paramedics and nurses and not just doctors. So there are a lot of options. My wonderful girlfriend is third year into a medical degree. She's going to be a doctor in a couple of years. And there are talks about her wanting to maybe go into emergency care and work on the air ambulance, at which point I would love to do that too. But I have a bit of a weird fancy about us working together, not in a weird sexual way, but just I think that would be cool as fuck. But she doesn't quite appreciate it as much as I definitely do.
She
just thinks it's weird that I would want to work with her as well as live with her. But I definitely could see that happening. I think I see us as a bit of a dream team. She sees us as a bit of a walking disaster. but there we go. That's just different points of view, different mindsets, I suppose. But yes, so that might happen. I am very interested in sort of minor injuries and that side of things as well. So again, as time goes by, I may decide to go and work in sort of a minor injuries unit and do a lot more treating and discharging of minor things. Just because it's a bit, you know, you can assess, treat, discharge and prescribe to somebody. You basically do the whole lot yourself. You don't have to rely on anybody. And I like that. I like being able to do that and investigate things yourself. There's plenty of options out there. There's a lot coming up. But again, I'm a big believer in not thinking too hard about too far ahead. You know, we've had conversations like this before. I'm a big believer in, you know, crossing those bridges when you come to them. And it's very important to sort of appreciate now and here and now and sort of, and not worry too much about the next thing, you know. Because who knows what might happen? You know, you can't plan for too far ahead in advance because you just don't know what's going to happen.
Sure.
I don't know is the honest answer. I have no idea, but I'm enjoying myself. And I'm quite happy to go along for the ride, you know. So,
brilliant. I think because of that, and based on that, it would be great to have you back as a guest on the podcast, say in a year's time, and catch up and see what's changed, what developments there's been, out a couple of more interesting stories, because obviously there's a lot that's going to go on within a year of being a paramedic. So thank you very much for being a guest on this episode.
Thank you for having me.
And you're, you know, accept this as an invitation to come back, and obviously, you know, my door's always open. You're always welcome to come and visit me on the boat, and it's been great reconnecting with you after some time, because we were really good mates, really close at uni, and unfortunately with us both getting our careers up and running and settling into a bit more of an adult lifestyle, it's been difficult to maintain and get the balance between
and you drift apart, I think. Yeah, it's easy to drift apart from people, and that's why I've got 3 weeks off, and I'm spending it reconnecting with us. I mean, like I said, I'm spending it getting drunk, but also reconnecting with as many people as I can, you know. And I think it's important to do that, to make time, because really, when you actually try, it's dead easy, you know. It's dead easy to just book a train down and come and see you
sure.
Excuse me, but yeah. So,
and it's been a real pleasure having you as well on the boat. You've picked it up really quickly.
Yes.
Your driving skills are pretty good for someone who I gave very little tuition to. And it's, I look forward to many more trips on the One Martha with you.
I'd definitely be back.
Well,
and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Yeah, and thank you for everyone that's listened to this episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. And we'll see you on the next episode.